What's up, y'all, and welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for being here, and we are so excited to share with y'all episode number 2 in the Bush podcast with Cole and Joel. Y'all, real quick, before the podcast starts, I've got to ask you to hit the follow button wherever you're listening to us, and please leave us a 5-star review. We're a brand new podcast, and we're really trying to grow. That really helps us out in the algorithm of wherever you're listening. We can't tell you how much we appreciate you doing that and taking that little bit of time, and really hope that you enjoy this episode of In the Bush podcast. In this episode, we have Nicole Apalian. Nicole was such a great guest. This episode is brought to you by Learn Hunt Harvest and BushSurvivalTraining.com. You guys go check out our websites there. You can also follow us on Instagram at In the Bush Podcast. You can also go to our personal Instagrams, which is Cole Wilkes Hunter and Joel V. Bushcraft. Thanks so much, and y'all enjoy this episode. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to In the Bush podcast with Cole and Joel.
Man, oh man, Paul. You know, the first time you do anything, it's always a mess up. And this time we've had such technical, it's been an hour of messing around with computers and cables and all that sort of stuff. I guess that's not our strong point. But here we are with our first official guest, Nicole Apalian.
Yay.
It's so nice to have you on. And thank you for the patience.
You know,
all the nonsense that
is. No worries. It just really solidifies that we all should really just be in the bush.
That's so true.
Oh, that's the truest thing I've heard this morning. Yeah. You know, it's funny because I don't think any of us are like sort of driven towards this technology. Mm-mm. But there is an amazing opportunity, if we learn to use some of it, to be able to have people like yourself spread amazing stories and influence people in a positive way. So I kind of try and walk that fine line.
Right. It's a great tool.
We're going to try and walk this fine line between, you know, living this, trying to express ourselves in that primitive way, and then also embracing technology that can be utilized in a positive way.
Yeah.
And so here we go.
Yeah.
Cole, how are you feeling today, man?
Man, I feel great, dude. It's, you know, this has been a long time coming. Joel and I have been talking about this, Nicole, for such a long time. And mm-hmm. So I don't know if you know, but Joel and I actually casted together for season 7. That's how Joel and I met, was up in New York, going to boot camp. So after I bawled my eyes out, me and him just became long lost brothers. And
That's where the friendship really started.
Yeah.
So that was one of the blessings of my season of Alone, was to be able to meet Cole and form this relationship.
Yeah.
And it's just led us to this, you know, to many hunting experiences, and now, you know, taking this deep, dark road down a podcasting world. And it's so nice to have you.
Yeah.
It's so nice to be in your beautiful house. Thank you for inviting me around. And we'd love to just to dive deep.
All right, and I'm ready.
I know you like to go deep, but first things first, you know, so Nicole, you obviously are probably known by a lot of people as being on season 2 and 5, right?
Right.
Okay, of Alone. But, you know, you're a herbalist, you're an author, you're a biologist, an anthropologist. You also have taught a lot of wilderness survival, primitive skills. And of course, I mean, I cycle back to this author part. I mean, you're just writing books like crazy. And you were just telling me about the online course that you produced, which I'm very interested in. I know Leah, my wife, would also love to take a look at that. So I feel like with you, there is so many avenues we can go down. And I kind of have a little rough idea of which avenue to go down. But I'd love you to just give us a kind of, in a nutshell, the sort of the history of Nicole Apalian.
Oh my gosh. Wow, absolutely. That's a big question.
That's a big question. Just whatever you think is relevant.
I'll nutshell it as best I can for you. How's that? Here's my elevator speech. it's going to be a long elevator ride, but we'll do our best. So I grew up pretty feral. I grew up in Massachusetts. I moved to Oregon for graduate school in 91. That's what got me out here. So I've been here for a while. But my stepdad was really my biggest influence. You know, he was a chemistry professor, and he'd come home early from work and we'd go canoeing, and we'd do a lot of camping in the summer, and we'd always go somewhere and bring our field guides. And he really fostered my love of the outdoors just really well. And so I decided to go into biology. There was no question of what I was going to go into. I did that for undergraduate and for one of my graduate degrees. And after I got, after I finished with that part of schooling, I moved all around. I did a lot of traveling and a lot of research. Worked on the crab boats up in Alaska for a while in the Bering Sea.
So you've really excellent sea miles.
Yeah, did some research on the Exxon spill, invertebrate and algae research, and traveled around the world. And finally, lived out of my bus for a long time in my 20s, and finally decided to join the Peace Corps. That's what first got me to your area, neck of the woods, to Botswana. Okay.
That's what took you to Africa.
That's what first took me to Africa. I moved there in 95 and was a game warden for the wildlife department there.
Was that a big culture shock for you or not too?
No, I'd always traveled. My dad's from overseas. I'm first generation. My dad's from Beirut, Lebanon. Oh. And so we'd traveled a lot growing up. It was a bit of a culture. It was a culture difference, that's for sure. But I just embraced it. I actually loved it over there. You know, with Peace Corps, it's nice because you go in and you're not there as an expat. You're there, you know, because you're not making a lot of money. Expats do when they travel to other countries.
They do.
So you're not living behind a gated community. Yeah. So you're living with people. You're learning the language. You live with a family at first in order to learn the language and get culture training. And then you make the same salary that someone would make who's local, which is kind of amazing for Peace Corps. I think it's a really good thing. So you live like local people do, and that really integrates you into the community.
That's the best way to do it.
It's the best way.
Yeah.
Was that kind of an eye opener for you, kind of going there and just, I mean, you know, just wage difference is huge, and everything about, you know, being there is probably a lot different.
Yeah, it was. You know, I mean, before that, I wasn't making a lot of money anyway. I was traveling. I was working up. I worked like 6 months, make enough money to travel for 6 months, and then do another research gig and make enough money to travel some more. So, and I was mostly living out of my Volkswagen bus during that period of time.
It strikes me that you weren't going there for the money.
No.
You're going there for the money. I could totally relate. I did the same thing. I would go work at sea for like 6 months to a year and then go travel for 5 months. That's all I wanted to do, was get the experiences.
Exactly. And that was kind of my 20s.
You spent most of the time in Botswana. I know you went to South Africa, my sort of home country.
I spent a lot of time there because after my Peace Corps gig ended, I joined, luckily I already had a master's in biology then. So I joined up with a lion research project and did that for a number of years. And so then I really moved into the bush, you know, lived in the middle of nowhere. It was just myself and my research partner. You know, this is in the 90s. We didn't have sat phones. We didn't have radio communications. We didn't even have radios, which is kind of ridiculous. So oftentimes, you know, I'd be by myself probably 6 hours from the nearest person. No one knew where I was. I was in the parks and we were allowed to go places no one else was allowed to go. So it's not like anyone would come along.
Wow.
You know, when I'm changing a flat tire next to, you know, a pride of lions, or I'm, you know, or my, you know, have to, you know, my radiator goes out. Or I remember a time I was changing my leaf springs and I was by myself at our research camp and the high lift jack kicked out and it fell on me, and luckily it landed like a centimeter from my nose. But I had to dig myself out before nightfall because, you know, the hyenas had come. So there was a lot of that over there.
That's the trick, is you don't want to be out there at night.
No, you don't.
You know, but if you have a car to sleep in, that's okay.
Yeah.
But Africa is very interesting like that. You have to be resourceful. I'm sure that you learned that there. I mean, you just don't have a lot of the availability of all of the conveniences like you do in a first world country. So
yeah, there was no safety net there. I think that's the big thing. Net. You know, going on alone, there's a safety net. At least you have someone to call. I mean, they're going to take them maybe 3 hours to get to you. So it's not as good a safety net. Yeah. But out there, if something happened, no one would get to me. You had to be completely self-sufficient.
completely self-sufficient. Absolutely. Yeah.
That's amazing.
That's such a liberating feeling.
Yeah.
And it's so humbling.
Yeah.
So how did you get in with, because you I know that you spend time with the San.
Yes. I have a longstanding community of San Bushmen in the Kalahari whom I've been working with for, I don't know, 15 years or so. And they're like second family to me. I actually am still working on a 14-year project on a book of plant uses of the Kalahari.
Wow.
Of mine over there. They actually had brought me aside and asked if this other woman and I would write down their ethnobotanical knowledge because it was being lost.
Yeah.
And there was no written record of it. So we've been working on that for a long time.
It's amazing how people are trying to extract and keep that knowledge alive, and how we get so influenced in the Western world by them. I mean, CyberTracker, right?
Right.
I mean, you've done some of the evaluations.
It's
all derived from the San.
Yeah.
A way to gain their knowledge and transfer it on.
Yeah. Their knowledge is incredible. Being out in the bush with them, I mean, when I was living in Botswana, especially at the lion research camp, I mean, that's where I learned what everyone kind of calls in survival skills, the soft skills, right?
The soft skills.
That's the most important.
They are.
Yes.
Animal communication. Yeah. It's the sixth sense. It's bird language. I mean, that's the stuff that keeps you alive.
I'm going to sound like such an, like a, I got the chills. I got the chills, Nicole.
Right?
You gave me the chills.
Forget about because, these things. They're
because
the most
those
skills
are
you can
the
have.
Skills
yeah.
that we
yeah.
need to have.
Yeah.
Those are the ones you like Cole, hey, she like took the words out of my mouth, like the sixth sense.
Yeah.
You
know,
the, right. These are the things that really count.
Yes. Because when there's a lion in your camp, when there's a mamba in, as I've had, you know, in the winter, open up your bonnet and there's a mamba and curled up on your engine block. I mean, these are things that like, you need to know the birds are going to tell you what's coming through your camp.
100%.
And if you don't know that there, you're going to not make it because you're living in a different ecosystem. You're literally part of that.
Literally part
system.
Of it. You know, like I can absolutely relate from my years of spending time at the Hadza, and they are an offshoot of each other. They actually
yes.
do. They connect way back. But when they're walking through the woods, it's not a mindless stroll trying to get from A to B. They're constantly in engagement with their surroundings.
Yeah.
Like I'm sure you've witnessed with the sand. They're looking at the ground and they're listening to the sounds. They're looking at the landscape and they read it in a way that we would read a book. Like they just have this intimate relationship with it. And it's very clear to me that that is one of the biggest missing links.
It is, absolutely.
For us in this modern
because
day.
Because the other stuff you can learn. You can learn the hard skills. You can learn how to tan a hide. You can learn how to make fire by friction. You can learn how to build a shelter. But those skills, you have to have incredible amount of dirt time in order to gain those skills. And those are the most important. So when I'm walking through the bush with this community of bushmen, I mean, first of all, they're listening to like 12 different things at once.
Yeah.
And they all talk at once. I actually did my doctoral PhD dissertation work with two communities of Hunty bushmen and Naro bushmen. And to get people alone was really hard. But when you're interviewing people and when everyone is in groups, they'll all talk at once. And I can't distinguish what everyone's saying at once, right? Usually we talk. We take turns talking, They all talk at once, but the thing is they can hear each other.
Yeah.
They can hear everything because they're so used to listening to every bird sound, everything going on in the bush. They can hear it all at once. So it's not like talking over people. It's very different.
Mm.
And they always know where they are. Like I remember being, you know, a little turned around in the bush and you ask this, I remember I asked my friend Uta, like, where are we? And he just points back to where we're going. Like
it's mind blowing.
It's incredible.
It took me a couple of visits to realize that when they roam an enormous amount of territory from the moment that they're born.
Yeah.
They get carried around through it, then they eventually start crawling through it, and then they eventually walk it, and then they hunt it. And they know exactly where they are at all times. It's not like, we're just going to randomly go and hope to stumble into an antelope. No, no, we're going to go down into that draw because that's where the antelope live.
Yeah.
Like they know the land intimately.
And that's such a place, right? Not only did they grow up in it, but, you know, they're teaching. And I think that's one of the real lessons I've learned from them from like over time is their teaching style and their parenting style, I got to say. I remember being there once and one of my friends asked one of the guys, Kakao, he asked him, you know, so how do you teach your children? And he said, well, we don't. we don't teach our children. Our only job for our children is to love them. And we teach other people's children. We discipline other people's children. But imagine that as a parent. Like, I'm a mom. I have three boys. Like, imagine not having to ever discipline or teach your child, but knowing they're going to be disciplined and taught, right? Your only job is to love them. But there's other children, your grandkids, your nieces, your nephews, cousins. Like, it's so much easier for kids to find a mentor who relates to them. Like, often they don't want to learn from their parents. So, and being able to, you know, teach those people something. Like, what a burden that could be lifted. We didn't have to live in that kind of community where you didn't have to do any of that except love your children. I've really tried to work that out in my life.
Having a community that you can trust to be like, if my child does step out of hand, that somebody else is going to be like, hey, look, that's not the way we do that here. And this is why. And having, like, you remember whenever your parents would tell you something and you'd be like, I'm not listening to that thing you said, but you hear that same message from somebody else and it transpired, it connects with you. Like, right. It's just because it's coming through your parents. You're like, I'm not listening to anything you're saying right now, but somebody else, it resonates with you because maybe it's an elder or something like that. So I think that's, you know, we've lost a lot of that community, that tribe, you know, everything about it. Like there's so many different rabbit holes we can go down with this, because look at the way a lot of the kids are today. They're isolated by themselves in their rooms. There's no parents even involved, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's the terrible, terrible attitude of parents not wanting to be bothered by their kids.
So right, which I don't understand.
Hand off an iPad to them or push them over to the TV so that they can get back to doing what they need to do. And so this is actually one of the questions I was wanting to ask you, is that tying all of this in, I know that we've probably had very similar experiences with spending time with these Indigenous people and looking at and learning the lessons and having a profound impact on us by them. Then coming back into the modern day world and trying to implement some of those lessons into our lives. So as a mother, is it two or three kids?
I lost my oldest one 10 years ago, and so I have two kids right now.
Two kids.
Two boys.
How do you influence them in that? Is there any way that you can orchestrate or influence them in those lessons that you've learned?
Yeah, you know, such a good question, because parenting nowadays is really difficult because we're not doing it in community.
It's the hardest job it's the hardest thing I've ever done in my life.
Yeah. So one of the things I did is I did try to integrate a lot of community when the kids were growing up, which was great when they were growing up. I mean, now we've been living fairly isolated for the last 10 years, but when they were little, we lived in a neighborhood, and that was really great because they, you know, were in and out of everybody's houses. We watched each other's kids. We helped each other out. And I've been a single mom since Quinn was two and he's 16 now. So for 14 years. So it's been a long time. And that's really difficult. That's especially difficult.
Absolutely.
But also, you know, taking them to the gatherings, you know, when my kids were little, I was pretty broke. And the gatherings, the skills gatherings I'm talking about, and for those who don't know, they're week-long survival skills or traditional skills gatherings where people gather together, instructors teach for free, and it's the cheapest summer camp in town. It's about $300 to go, and you just learn from all these incredible instructors who are the best in their field.
That's where we officially met.
Yes,
at one of them.
Obviously
we had the link of Alone and we just hit it off straight away. But as you say, I mean, when I saw these little kids running around, just being able to be feral and just play with sticks and stones and then have a bunch of mentors to instruct them in any which way with handling knives, making fires. I mean, that is the closest that I have seen kids behaving like I've witnessed the Hadza kids behaving in their community.
Exactly. And I would go to, you know, five gatherings a year when the kids were growing up. And so that was about, we'd always go early and we'd always stay late. So probably 2 to 3 months of the year we were camping and at these gatherings. And we'd yank them from, if they were in school at the time, we'd yank them from school and go to these because they learned so much more. So that was an integral part of raising them, is them being able to go to these things, be very free, and also have other adults around.
Other mentors
around. And other kids to just, you know, run off with and get into trouble. I mean, even at home, you know, when the kids do something, it was generally my middle one, Colton. He's awesome. You know, and he was doing something that was super risky, which they should be. I'd often just be like, you go do that. I just can't watch.
That's,
which is really the best. Yeah. I think that's a really good parenting. That's really good parenting advice. Kids are supposed to be taking risks. Yep. Now kids can't even balance on things because they've taken away, you know, the old types of playgrounds and made them too safe. You know, kids should be climbing trees. They should be testing their limits. Yeah, they're going to get a little hurt now and then, but, you know, nothing major usually.
I agree. I mean, I can't even comprehend, like, when I was, Talon's now six, and when I was five, I had a box of matches and a pocket knife.
Yeah.
Grandfather gave me a pocket knife, and my parents had no problem with me walking around and making fires with matches. And I think about, you know, Talon does do it now. I'm sure, I know, Cole, we've talked about this, and you, the same thing, man.
Oh, yeah.
Running around, you know, in the woods and just playing with, I guess, items that would be considered dangerous.
Right.
But,
yeah,
I mean, risks, as human beings, risks are part of this human experience.
If you don't learn how to manage risks, you're not going to succeed in life. I mean, it's really important. I remember when kids and I, we were camping with some friends and a bunch of people I didn't know. It was like this big gathering, not a skills gathering, and by the river. And it was a big rafting trip. And no one had made, it was getting dark and no one had made a fire. So my kids were 3 and 7 at the time. So they started, they gather all the things, they got the mat, you know, they started, they made the fire. And someone kid said, do you know your kids are playing with fire? What is wrong with you? I said, yeah, because no one else did it. Good for them, you know?
Yeah, you probably felt pride.
Totally proud of them. Of course they should say you should make fire. Oh, that's the best thing you can do for your kids, is give them independence.
Absolutely.
Like that.
Especially when it comes to these ancient skills.
Yeah.
You know, like I always say, like breaking rock, you know, making stone tools, shooting a bow and arrow, making fire. There is very few things that you can do that connect you with the essence of being a human being. And exactly. A few of those things, I know that when I do them and when others do them, especially, you know, you and other people in part of the primitive skills community, would attest to how invigorating and how connected we feel when we get to practice those ancient skills.
It's one of the solutions to our modern life and what is it causing anxiety and stress and depression for people. You know, you look at people doing an ancient skill, they're not unhappy and they're not thinking about any other things. Now that comes back to the sort of circling around about lessons of learned from the Kalahari Bushmen.
Yeah.
You know, it's the power now is what it is.
Mm-hmm. They live
funny things that happened the day before and things like that around the campfire because it's funny. But you know,
yeah, and they want to laugh just living, like any other person.
Yeah, but they're living in the present moment. And that's one of the things we've lost, you know, especially with time. This is a really just a short anecdote.
Mm.
We were, again, this is like, I don't know, a decade or two ago. And we were with the Bushmen and my friend, John Young, actually,
oh,
the
John Young.
Tracker. Yeah. Okay. He was there sitting next to me and he pulled out this old pocket watch. I don't know. He said he didn't even know why he pulled it out. You know, he pulled it out and he looked at it. And this guy, Kanema, who was one of my biggest mentors, said to him, is that a timepiece? And John said, yeah. He says, oh, we don't like those. And John said, why don't you like those? And he said, because every time someone pulls out a timepiece, the next thing you do is rude. And you know what it does? It pulls you out of the present moment. Think of that. You're having dinner with someone. You've got a cell phone out. You look at it. You're not in that conversation anymore.
Yeah.
You're thinking about what you got to do or someone else.
Isn't that truth right there?
Yeah, that is deep.
Being present.
Yeah.
Being present. Yeah.
I think I can speak on behalf of many different African tribes that I've been so fortunate to spend time with. All of them do not worry about the tomorrow and they live in the today.
Always. Everyone gets
always.
Zero. Yeah.
And the level of happiness that they encounter daily, it's just incredible how, I mean, a lot of people wouldn't make sense to because they don't have much.
Yeah.
So they would wonder, like, how can these people be so content and why do they not suffer with any mental illness and what, why? Well, because they're focusing on the now.
Yeah.
Family, community, that is everything to them.
Absolutely everything. Because, you know, a real healthy culture, it's connection to yourself, it's a connection to nature, and it's a connection to others, community. And they have all of that in spades.
I would love to hear your obviously anecdotal or if you some research back stuff, but I would love to hear your opinion on our relationship with nature. This is obviously a big topic for people like us, and we are big advocates for getting close with nature. And you hear a lot of things that come out, like, scientifically, they're understanding that, you know, the smell of pine needles and, you know, all these things have like physical changes on our body. Now, this is something you're very good at. I mean, you have an apothecary, right?
Would that be Nicole's apothecary.
Yeah, Nicole's apothecary. Your plant knowledge is incredible. I've got two of your books, which the way that they're laid out are incredible.
Thank you.
I love how concise they are, easy just to locate the plant and see what that plant is good for, the medicinal use. I'd love you to talk a little bit about, you know, this relationship with nature, how you think we're really meant to live with that connection to nature. Anything that you're willing to share, I think that topic needs to be talked about more.
It's an important topic because, you know, for most people, we're not going to be able to go back and live as hunter-gatherers. I mean, it's not feasible, right?
No.
So we have to take the question of nature connection, which I think is hugely important in your daily life, and we have to integrate it into modern society because that is where we live. And that becomes more difficult, right? Because we have access so often to our phones, to the internet, to TV, to, you know, distractions that take us out of our present moment and really disconnect us from nature. And, you know, I use these things, right? Obviously, I write books. I'm on my computer. I use social media as a great tool. But you have to think of it as a tool and not as a daily way of living. And that's a good way to use technology. But coming away from that, daily nature exposure is huge. And being able to live in nature or go camping or take time in nature or spend dirt time and really be outside is so connective. And that people really realize, I think, their true happiness when they get to do that kind of thing. When you get to really immerse yourself, as you and I have done, and you too, Cole, you know, like when you really are out there and immersing yourself and spending, you know, months in nature by yourself, let's say, or with other people, it really like reawakens your primal DNA.
Absolutely.
All of a sudden, I remember being on alone and I'd spent 7 weeks by myself before that. Like I remember being on alone the first time and, you know, I was asked, like, what's the hardest part about the show? For me, the hardest part was the transition home.
100%.
It's terrible. You know, you don't realize how much you're being exposed to and being bombarded with on a daily basis. You know, all of a sudden when I was out there, my primal brain was open. I could hear everything. My intuition was spot on.
Yes.
I mean, that's why I heard my son call me home. That's why I left on season one. I had three meals in camp. I was super happy. I was only lost 10 pounds.
Which was what, 60 or 70? How long were you out there for on season one?
57 days,
which is a long time.
Long time.
In that time, the level of connection that you form with that land
huge.
Is undeniable.
Yeah, and I was still really happy. I felt like I had months to go. You know, it was a pretty good, I was all, you know.
Your attitude always blew my mind because you were always so chipper. Like you remind me a lot of my mom because I don't think there's really anything that could have been thrown your way that wasn't just like you just made the best of no matter what. I thought that was super awesome. Yeah. But I think to your point about us not having that, like after you've been outside and your body's been touching the earth and nature all around you, it's seriously like something changes. And same thing like what Joel was getting to, like a lot of people want this one pill to fix their problems. And I honestly think that one pill is Mother Nature and our, you know, our earth. Like it has everything that we need as long as you can gather the right things and understand where to go to get those things. Like it really is a one pill.
It is. You know, that's a great point, Cole, because that kind of brings us back to, you know, what is it about? Like, how do you connect with nature, right? And there's different ways. I mean, just going for a walk out your back door, great. Spending, you know, real dirt time in nature, great. Taking your kids out fishing, taking your kids out doing something. But also, you know, you can connect to nature in other ways. Like I have a deep connection with nature because of herbal medicine. First of all, it saved my life. Well, I would not be here talking to you now if I...
Absolutely. And I mean, we'll get to that in a minute for sure. Yeah.
If there wasn't about the power of herbal medicine. So that's a great connector. So one of my things I love to do and one of my sort of biggest passions through my books and my blogs and through workshops is connecting people to herbal medicine and wild foods so that because it provides a way for you to go out into nature and have a little bit of a purpose. of gathering, of foraging, of looking for things. And then you can share that with others or go out with groups. And that is also good because that brings in community too. I mean, yes, we were on alone, but it's not the best way to live. I mean, I loved my time out there. Mm-hmm. At the time I was a really broke single mom and, you know, it was really hard. And being out in nature for 2 months was amazing.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Wouldn't want that. But
I just have to say hallelujah to all this, man. This is just fantastic. You know, before we end so I don't want to get into all the ins and outs of the alone. You've probably I know I have told so many times.
Oh yeah. No need.
I'm just, there's one thing that I'm really interested in with all of the participants. I want to know mentally and spiritually, what significant happened to you out there? Like, can you recall the noticeable changes that maybe happened to you spiritually? And I'm not really too worried about physically.
Yep. Nope. Two
mentally
things.
From day one till to the end.
So two things come to mind that are pretty clear. So about 30 days in, all of a sudden I realized that I had arrived. And by what I mean by I had arrived is that the birds weren't alarming for me anymore. There was this mink whom I could barely see. I only saw its little crab trail, and I could never see it, but I knew I'd arrived because I was sitting out. I remember this because it was actually not raining. There were only 2 days that it didn't rain all day there. Because, you know, it's fall, winter. Tough. It was rough. I was sitting out on my sit spot, and I was eating something. I can't remember what. And all of a sudden, this mink came up to me with its crab and sat like a foot from me. Ate its crab, looked at me, was really chill, and then slowly meandered off.
With a kind of body language telling you that he completely accepts you.
Yes. And I knew that I had arrived. Mm. Like nothing bothered. And the same happened with the bears. The male bear and I started foraging on the beach together, you know, 30 feet apart from each other. And I remember one time I drowned one of the huge, really nice cameras. It fell, the wind picked up and I was swimming in the water and it drowned. So they had to bring me another. Like, you know, they're big no contact, but they had to bring me another one. And they pulled up towards the beach and they looked, and then the bear left because of them. And they're like, did you know there was a bear right there? And I'm thinking, I was like, yeah, we forage on this beach every day.
Yeah.
Like we're eating the same foods. We're chill. We know each other, you know, and that's like animal communication. Because when I first got dropped, there was a mom and cubs that I just put out the vibe of, I'm here in peace. You know, there's everything is your babies are safe. And those bears never checked out my camp.
Never.
They always check out your camp.
Yeah.
Always. They already knew. I already told them. I mean, people don't believe in animal communication, but your dog is at the door before they can see your car. Just as simple as that.
The only person that wouldn't believe in that is the person that hasn't had any of the experiences.
Yeah.
Like these experiences you're talking about, I mean, they well up. I just well up with emotion. It kind of wants to make me cry because that level of relationship with the landscape is so important to us.
Yeah.
And we only get to have it in these fleeting moments. Like that moment you probably will think about for the rest of your life.
Rest of my life.
And wish to experience some of it again.
Yeah. So that was one of the big ones. And then the other one was, you know, towards the end, you know, when my son called me home, you know, the night of day 56. And it was like he picked up the phone and said, Mom, I'm done. I need you home right now. Mm-hmm. And he was 12 at the time. And he was just staying with a friend of mine.
Did that come in as like just a strong energetic sense?
Yes. Yeah. But it was like he picked up the phone and I heard it. And so the next morning I was like, and I'm gone. You know, I had no idea. Also, I had no idea that people were suffering. Like we hadn't seen season one yet, right? Yeah. I had no idea what was going on. I was just like, sorry, I got to go. And, but through that experience that night, I just stayed up late because I was thinking about things and I knew I was going to be leaving. And I really thought about the experience. And what really, really keyed in is, wow, like, because I did some big trauma before that, you know, I'd been sick for a while and then other things had happened in life and other things I won't go into. And then 2 years prior, they'd actually asked me for season one and I'd said no, because my son had passed a year before that. And I just didn't feel like I could either be alone or leave my kids yet, my other boys. So as I said, if it's a good show and it flies, call me for season two. So they did. And but I got to that point and I realized, wow, like I've come through all this with peace and joy in my heart. Mm-hmm. And that was a really big moment for me.
Do you feel like that alone experience, which you probably didn't realize at the beginning, but maybe when you're in it or at the end of it or way after it, that would have been the exact medicine you needed to heal from that loss?
Yeah, I think it was big medicine. And we had a cabin on the coast that we actually still have, and it's on 22 acres and really private and just really, it's a real nature cabin. And the kids and I spent most of that year after Beau passed at that cabin. We just every chance we could get, we were there, because I knew nature was healing, and that was a healing place for us. And we were just outside as much as we possibly could be.
I commend you for knowing how to heal, well, how to heal at least parts of it, because I can't imagine that losing a child ever goes away.
Yeah. No, it doesn't. You know, I still deal with it. But anyway,
You know,
you gotta figure out a way to come through that.
You have to come through
you
that.
Have
and,
to.
And you know, I'm a believer in the Great Spirit, the Almighty, and I have to believe that there is purpose in it.
Yeah.
You know, I sometimes you don't know where the purpose is, what the meaning is, but I there's an element of trust, I think, for me personally, that just has to be placed in. There's a meaning there.
Well, I've heard it too, that God only puts certain circumstances in your life that he knows you can deal with. Right. So,
and that's a
good and bad.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
That's a good point, because let's talk about that. So, I mean, that's just one shadow. You were officially diagnosed with MS, multiple sclerosis.
Yeah.
I understand that disease. I think I did mention to you, my aunt had it. She was my entire, as long as I can remember, she always had it. She was completely debilitated by it.
Yeah.
Sitting in front of me here now, I know you've been diagnosed quite a while, and I'd like you to talk a little bit about when you were diagnosed, how long ago that was. But when I look at you, I mean, I don't know your age. It doesn't really matter. But when I look at you,
I'm wicked old.
Like 38, something like that.
You're
54. Okay. There is a vibrance to you. There is a vitality to you that radiates off you. Your skin complexion, the sparkle in your eyes, you are what I would look at you not knowing you and be like, that's a healthy adult female woman.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you are the picture of health.
Yeah.
So you gotta tell us, when were you diagnosed? How have you managed to deal with it? Because obviously to the untrained eye, no one would notice that you have that disease.
Right. Yeah. So I got sick in 1999. I was 29.
Oh, wow. That's long time
ago. A long time ago. I got sick quickly, and I got diagnosed at 30. Finally, I didn't know what was going on at first. My balance was off. I was really tired. I felt like I had the flu all the time, just like sheer exhaustion. Mm. And some weird pains, like shooting pains. And then finally I lost my eyesight in my left eye. And that's what made me go in to see the neurologist. And that's called optic neuritis. It's a very classic first sign of MS. And then I went in and had MRIs, and they showed lesions on my brain. And, you know, I had a very easily diagnosable case of multiple sclerosis. I classic case. I went downhill super quickly. So I was super scared. I was 30. I was super sick. My whole life ahead of me. And I was really, really scared. So I listened to my neurologist. Bad idea. anyway, I listened to my neurologist.
Well, here's the question. What did they actually tell you? What expectations did they set for you?
They didn't know at the time, but I went downhill quickly. I started losing the left side of my body. I mean, it came to the point where I couldn't even pick up a book, or pick up this phone, like right next to me. Like I didn't have enough strength in my body. I went from, I had to quit everything. I ended up quitting my job. I was teaching biology full time at the time. I quit my band. I quit pretty much everything. Mm. And I started using a cane. And then I was in a wheelchair at night. And then I went to where most days I was bedbound.
Jeez. Okay. Ugh. So hold.
Almost three years. 2.5, 3 years. Yeah.
Gosh.
I was not the person I am now.
Were they feeding you medication, a bunch of prescriptions and stuff like that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was on medications. I was on medications, counter medications. I was on daily injections, which reminded me every day that I was sick, right? Nothing about giving yourself an injection every day, telling yourself I'm sick. I'm sick.
Oh,
I'm sick.
Yeah, that mindset has got to be just destroying by itself, like without all the pharmaceutical stuff on top of it.
Yes.
Well, there's no doubt that that mindset would cripple a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, let me back up. Not that mindset. That diagnosis would mentally cripple a lot of people.
Mm.
And it would just be a downhill spiral probably for the rest of their life.
Yeah.
So how did you find that courage to break through that?
Yeah, that's what it was. I had, so all of a sudden, you know, and I started losing my brain function, which was really my concentration. I couldn't concentrate on anything. I love my brain. My favorite thing.
You need one. We need it.
So I got to the point where I had no hope left. I was bedbound and I thought, this quality of life, if this is my quality of life, like, I don't want to live this.
No.
Yeah. So that was a big turning point for me. I was 32, super sick, and finally just said, I need to change this. So my first step out was, you know, step by step. First step out was seeing an Ayurvedic physician who was a friend of ours and changing my diet. And I've been gluten-free since then.
Okay.
So yeah, changed my diet and started going on some herbs. And then I got my brain functioning enough. Like, I'm a scientist. Like, I love nothing I love better. And part of what I do in my work is deep diving into peer-reviewed academic research.
Okay.
And then reframing it for others and putting it out in a way that they could understand. Like, I love that. So that's what I did. I started deep diving into mostly research papers out of Asia. And that's when I discovered, you know, first of all, diet makes such a difference. Life, mind-body connection, you know, started doing daily gratitudes, started doing yoga, things that I could gradually add on. And I slowly was starting to get a little better. And then finally, the last real sort of, I don't know, I want to say nail in the coffin because it's the opposite, right? It's
yeah.
The opposite.
Yeah, what you're saying.
Light in the, I don't know, the, light the in
final,
the sky.
The final nail out of the coffin.
Was herbal medicine. Yeah. And that's why I have such a passion for it. You know, reading about medicinal mushrooms and the things that they can do and how they're immunomodulatory and anti-inflammatory. And like, this was not, like, everyone's talking about medicinal mushrooms now.
Yeah.
This is 25 years ago. No one was talking about this stuff then. And
that, you know, Cole, me, you and I, we love our mushrooms.
Yes, sir. Yes.
Yes.
This podcast stemmed from Joel and I sitting together, you know, and that's where a big part of this vision has come from. So,
we actually had a distinct message in a mushroom ceremony, that is psilocybin mushroom ceremony, to start a podcast. And so we're just obeying and we're trying it out. But I'm with you. Mushrooms are the most incredible, incredible things. And I use them daily.
Yeah.
And yes, now we're at the point where we can dive into this.
Now,
I
want to
get into this. Medicinal mushrooms, medicinal plants, like, this is your thing.
This
podcast is, you know, bushcraft, hunting, you know, survival. This is where we, the nuts and bolts of what we really want to get into. Tell us about your favorite mushrooms to harvest and why.
Yeah, well, the ones that I utilize every day are lion's mane, because it actually increases nerve growth factor. So anyone dealing with any sort of nervous system condition, it's incredible. It helps with gut inflammation. So lion's mane mushroom is my number one. Reishi mushroom. I mean, it affects stress, cortisol levels, anxiety, hormonal balance, the amount of, and all of them are immunomodulatory. All of them are antiviral. All of them do all these other things that are anti-inflammatory.
Immunomodulatory?
Yeah. So with MS or any other autoimmune disease, you can't have things like I can't take personally echinacea, astragalus, golden seal. They're immune boosting, and they boost my immune system. So my autoimmune disease will kick back in. But there are certain medicinal mushrooms. Chaga is an exception. I personally can't do chaga because it is too boosting, but some people can. But for me, the reishi, turkey tail, lion's mane, and cordyceps mushrooms, which I take in a dual extracted tincture form every day. And that's important how you take it, because just taking it in your tea, you're only getting water soluble compounds. You're missing half the compounds. So that's why I make it in my apothecary, is because so people can access like the dual extracted form that actually works for everything.
Hmm.
You've told me about this before.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell the listeners how you make tincture, the double extracted tinctures?
You bet. So for mushrooms and lichens, most of them need a dual extraction. And what all that simply is extracting things in alcohol and separately extracting compounds in water. And the simple version of that is, you know, if you take anything, you know, it's all about chemistry, right? Mm. So if you're looking at what medicinal compounds are soluble in, you can't access them unless you can get them out of that mushroom, right? And a lot of people just by taking like a mushroom pill, et cetera, you know, that has to go through your gut. And most people in Western society, their guts are messed up.
Are a mess, yeah.
Yeah, they've got leaky gut. They've got, you know, so much stems from the gut. And
so they're not actually
more
able
more.
To extract those nutrients?
Exactly. Mm. In a tincture form, you take it and you put it in your mouth and you actually absorbs it in 4 to 5 minutes into your bloodstream. So you get all of the medicine.
Wow.
But to get that medicine, to access it, first, I extract the mushrooms in alcohol for 2 months. And
2 months. And is that when you're doing the extraction, is that the whole fruiting body?
The whole fruiting body.
Okay, you don't grind it up or anything?
Yeah, well, I grind it up to make it more soluble, to make it to increase the surface area.
Yeah.
But I use fruiting body of the mushroom. Okay. So you grind that up, you extract it, alcohol, and that gets all the triterpenoids and all the steroids, all those things that steroidal hormones and things that don't come out in water. You can't access that in tea. So mushroom coffee is great, but you're missing all those.
Mm.
And then after that process, you can take that same, you can use the same fruiting bodies because you haven't actually accessed the other medicine yet.
Oh, true.
Because there are water-soluble compounds like the beta-glucans and the polysaccharides. Mm. That's all the anti-cancer stuff. Does other things too, but you extract it in that, and then you mix it back at a ratio of 3 parts of the alcoholic extraction to 1 part of the water extraction. And there is your dual extracted tincture. Now, in my apothecary, I do another step called the spagyric method, which actually takes the minerals, burns them, and puts them back into it. So you also get the minerals of the mushroom.
Mm.
Most places don't do that, but I am able to do that in our apothecary. So it's really a three-step process.
And people can go online onto your website and purchase.
They can.
These tinctures, yeah.
Awesome.
What mushroom do you think has helped the most with MS?
I think for me, reishi and lion's mane would be the top two. I couldn't distinguish between. I take all four every day because it's so important.
Yeah.
But those are the top two.
Obviously, you've made a lot of lifestyle changes to deal with the disease, and it's working extremely well. Do you think that the medicinal aspect of the mushrooms is probably has the biggest effect, or
that and diet? And you know, you can't really discount nature connection and the power of the mind-body connection and the power of gratitude. I have everything I do on a free blog on my website. So if someone goes on NicolaPellion.com, they can look it up and see what I take daily just for access. But that really works for, most of my family, we're all taking medicinal mushrooms every day.
Yeah.
Even my son, Quinn, who's 16,
he
takes lion's mane mushroom every day because of the nerve growth, increasing his brain capacity, right?
There's a tangible difference.
Yes.
Taking it.
I'm going to get to the point where people who are not microdosing and taking medicinal mushrooms are going to be like losing out.
Zero negative side effects.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's almost like one of those things, like, why wouldn't you take it? Because it's already, it does all this. Like, and it, like, you don't have to have something for this to be beneficial to you guys.
No, you don't.
Right?
And they actually affect everything. It affects your gut. It affects, which everything stems from depression and anxiety to many diseases, that it helps your heart. It helps your circulatory system. It's helping your brain. I mean, there's nothing. It's helping your hormonal balance. It's actually incredible. And cordyceps, a lot of people who are athletes take that because it increases your lung capacity. All of the medicinal mushrooms, I have been a mushroom fortress, and I think everyone should be taking that every day, whether you're making it yourself, which I teach people how to make it themselves if you want to, or if you don't feel like it, get it, buy it off the website, but you can make it yourself too.
That's cool.
I think everyone should be taking those every day. There's there's no reason not to, and there's so many reasons to.
So many reasons to. And then, even just sort of the medicinal aspect aside, one of the most engaging family activities when Talon was super young, like 2 years old, was to go mushroom hunting.
Yes, it's so fun.
And then especially when it's like your chanterelles and they're everywhere. I mean, they just run around like, I got one, daddy, and just loving it.
Yeah.
And it's such a great, fun way to get out and engage with nature, just like we've been talking about with the family.
Yeah, and that's so important. That's a huge part of my healing too, really, nature. I mean, I was always connected with nature, but the healing power of nature can't be underestimated.
So, question has to be asked.
Yeah.
Has the magic mushroom, psilocybin, been a part of your practice?
Mm-hmm.
And has it Have you noticed big benefits?
So I do. Yeah. So I microdose psilocybin, which for those listening who haven't, listeners don't know, when you microdose, you don't actually feel the effects. Yeah. Macrodosing is very different, as we all know. But for anyone listening, microdosing, you don't feel the effects. You don't notice it, but you might notice things like decrease in anxiety, decrease in depression, maybe a little more opening of the mind. And I pair it with lion's mane, as you're generally supposed to.
I would say enhanced focus too.
Enhanced focus, yeah. And so I do. I have a microdose practice. Okay. At the moment, I'm doing every other day. For a while, I was doing the Stamets 4-on-3-off. Mm. You know, but you know, I heard him speak once, and you know, he's like, "You know how I came up with that? I made it up." All right. I made it up. He said, so there's no real studies that have been done yet.
Okay.
Not yet. So do what works for you. You know, I sometimes I do that. Sometimes I mix it up a little bit. But it is an important part of my practice, personal practice. So I think microdosing is fabulous.
I think it's absolutely one of the most useful tools that we could take advantage of in a time where mentally we are so challenged.
Yeah.
We're overstimulated, we're stressed. And here is what I think a sacred medicine that is for our use as human beings to enhance us and our relationship with others. I mean, hey, Cole, when we hunt, I mean, microdosing has such a drastic sort of it really helps connect us to the hunt, to the animal, to that sixth sense that we've been talking about.
Yeah,
it just hones us in.
Well, I think with a lot of us humans, like whenever we get out there, we live such a fast-paced life. I think what it does really, and just to clarify, Joel and I are out there tripping out and seeing things and stuff like that, right? This is it's on a minimal dose to where we can feel it come into our system, but it just gives us this attachment. It slows us down to the pace of nature. Like we're living today as human beings. If you're going into the city and you're going into town every day, it is so fast paced that when you step into nature and you try to move that fast pace, that's when, like when Nicole was talking about everything bumping and scaring and, you know, realizing that you're there, when she finally slowed down and became accepted, like that's almost what the mushrooms do to you. Your awareness of everything around it gets in heightened, and you can see and feel things that are going on that you probably normally wouldn't without it. I mean, it's a huge benefit to just slow you down and you're observant of everything that's going around, like the wind, the bugs, the bees, everything.
Yeah. And I'd say for anyone listening who's like, you know, has fear around it, because people do have fear around things that are new or different. You know, again, I'm a scientist. The science backs it up.
It's like,
the
science backs it up.
That's right.
Yeah.
It absolutely does. Like, just to circle back what we were saying, like there is very little reason to not. Well, there is reason. I mean, I do know anyone that has serious mental illness like schizophrenia and bipolar should stay clear of any psychedelic medicines. But apart from that, everyone else is good to go, from what I understand. But is that pretty accurate?
Yeah, I mean, but for people with anxiety and depression, it has made, I know some people who have been taking, who have been microdosing, who had huge problems with that, and it has made a world
of
difference.
Yeah, I've met several, same thing. And particularly doing the big, what some people call the heroic dose, you know, 3 grams upwards.
Yeah, there's actually a great Netflix special on that talks about it. Yeah. And I think it's Paul's. I think it's Fantastic Fungi.
Yep.
I've seen that.
Really
that's
good.
That's really good.
But also if you're, you know, if people are a little, I know it's not legal everywhere, et cetera, but the medicinal mushrooms also, like, they're legal. They've been researched. They have, you know, I don't know, 60 years of research behind them, and they're really impactful. So
they really are.
Yeah. Mushrooms are our friend.
mushrooms are definitely our friend. Yeah. And so let's, did you have any other?
I do. Questions? So I wanted to go back just a second. And Nicole, you're talking about mind and body. Okay. Yeah. I think a lot of people don't. Or I'll tell you what I believe, and then you can tell me what you think, okay? Because I think our mind and our body is so able to repair and heal itself if you have that mindset and just sitting down thinking that you are repairing yourself, your mind and body can physically do it. Do you believe at all any of that?
I 100% believe that. So, you know, there's lots of studies. When people are told that they're sick, they get sicker, right? Right away. And right that's away. Not hypochondria. That is your mind telling your body that you are indeed sick. And that happened to me. I mean, I went downhill really fast. And when I was trying to pull out of that, one of the biggest things that I did was doing gratitudes, being in nature, keeping a positive attitude. I mean, even if your day is going really poorly, and we all have those days, like I think some people look at me and think, maybe she doesn't have those days. Oh, I have them. Like we all have them,
everyone
right?
Does.
Everyone has
that
them.
That is the human experience.
Yes, it is. And even in the worst possible times, you can pull out a gratitude. You really can. And actually, that giving thanks for something externally causes a huge internal shift. And there's been lots of research around this and makes you healthier. I mean, even when my kids were little, I mean, we always do gratitudes around the dinner table. But, you know, when they were teenagers, sometimes like the gratitude were a little harder to pull out, like ketchup, you know?
Yeah.
You just got to roll with it. You got to roll with ketchup. Yeah. You know what? Then when you see them with other people doing gratitude, they're doing it right.
Yeah. It's so funny. We do that in the evenings too. Talon will be like, I'm grateful for Pokemon. And I'm like, oh God, that's not what I was hoping for.
You gotta take it. You gotta take it. It's a good practice. Yes. And glad he's grateful for Pokemon, you know?
Yeah.
It's well, okay.
The point being that creating that constant thought process
of positive thinking.
Of positive thinking.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well,
you know, that was it's always
it's okay. We have a little bit of a lag. But that's kind of where I was kind of going with that. Like, if you, like, could you just imagine if changing your mindset was to heal you? Like, that almost sounds ridiculous. But just have, if you were to have a doctor that came in and told you that you had cancer and everything was going or whatever, and he lied to you and he told you everything is doing great. Just keep up that strong mindset and believe that you're going to make it and you're fighting this and winning. And then the next day you did that and then you changed and you start doing exercises and you start eating good because you believed that it was making that difference and you healed yourself. Would that not be amazing? I mean, it just.
Well, that happens. I mean, look at the power of
placebo effect.
Yeah, placebo effect, power of prayer, power of positive thinking. I mean, all of these have been shown. Even, you know, if you're in a hospital and there's a, if you have a window versus not having a window, you heal faster. If you even have a picture of nature in the room, you heal faster.
Yes.
So obviously your mind is a powerful, powerful thing. And it needs to be part of your daily practice. Yeah.
It does.
Positive thinking and giving thanks.
The something that has to be asked because I have to alone is an experience that is just unlike anything else. The thing that alone and all my other time out in the woods being alone on different experiences has done to me, and then you couple that with the time I've spent with the Hadza in particular and with their families and really integrating with them, is taking all those experiences, realizing what we really do need as human beings. But then walking that fine line between wanting to practice and exhibit certain things in my lifestyle, but then being sort of slave to certain things in this modern world.
Oh, it's the dilemma we all have.
So you have, so I'm assuming we probably have, all three of us, I know, have this, it's a fight. It's a constant fight to get through life in a way that we want to fit in with others because we want to have a partner. We want to have kids. We want our kids to go to school and have a community. We can't take them off into a cabin up in the middle of Alaska where there's no social interaction so that we can only eat wild food and only forage for all our food and fish and live a lifestyle closer to a hunter-gatherer. You hit the nail on the head, is that it's not feasible. Mm-hmm. It's not feasible if you want to have any sense of community.
Right.
And you want to have kids that can actually have the choice of what road they want to go down. Yeah. If you go and take them up into the middle of nowhere, they're not going to know any better, and they're going to be social rejects. How do you manage to like walk that line each day?
Well, that is such a small question.
Nothing like the big D. You said you were going deep here.
We're going deep.
All right,
I can't tell you what. I'll give you a minute to think about it. And I think what we should do is let's do a round table. I'll go first because I know we all have this dilemma. My dilemma is that I'm looked at as feral by a lot of people. And I know deep down inside me that feral part, that wild part, that wolf is a part that I need to express in order to be a fulfilled human being, a man. I've got to do that. So I can't suppress it. And being out in the woods only allows me to release it.
Mm-hmm.
Hunting, tracking, you know, getting dirt on my hands, getting fire smoke all over my clothes and my hair, and just getting in it makes me feel alive. And yet in society, the surface level talk and the whole like niceties and the whole expectation of like, well, you've got to use this fork and this knife to eat this way, and you do this because, well, you're expected to. I don't conform to that.
Yeah.
That doesn't speak to me.
The amount of times my kids weren't using utensils, I said, well, you didn't use utensils on alone. Anyway, exactly. So many times.
Well, that's the thing though, that line of trying to fit in, because at the end of the day, I've realized that I do want to fit in society. I do want to be accepted. I do want to have friendships, and I certainly want my wife and my son I want us to gel. I want us to be together, and I want us to all have the freedom to live the kind of lives we want to live, but we also have to meet certain needs.
Right.
So that is my battle, is to walk that daily line of how to find my time to be feral, and then how to find the time to just suck it up and fit in.
Ooh, the sucking it up and fitting in is hard. So I think we're probably cool. Yeah.
It's so hard. Yeah. It's so hard to fit in whenever you're like us, y'all.
You got to find your people.
You have to find your people, and you kind of have to be malleable and put on face sometimes. You know what I mean? Because there are those situations and those people that we're going to be around that we're just not going to click with. And it's just, you know, you can spot somebody like Joel and I, like all of us, I can already tell, like, we're going to have to meet and do another podcast because we are the same. We're cut from the same cloth. And whenever we get out there into those areas, like you can spot us from a long ways away. Right.
Yeah.
Something a little bit different about this woman.
But it is finding your people and finding people who will accept you for really who you are. Because I'm at the age, I really don't give a crap what anyone thinks about me at this point. Like, I am who I am. I like who I am. I'm going to say I'm a little blunt. I tend to tell people what's on my mind, especially like my close friends and family, you know, and they're used to that. I'm nice.
That's a good quality.
But yeah. I am transparent. You know, I like to say what's on my mind. Do I always do that in public? No, that's none of their business. You know what I mean? I do that with people I love because that's where it matters. So I think the first step is really finding your people and making sure that those are the people that are going to bring out those best qualities in you too, because it is easy to get complacent, even if you're feral.
I think I'm lucky that I don't suffer with insecurities.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I do have it. Everyone's got insecurities.
Oh, yeah, I got them.
but I feel like finding the right people that truly see you for who you are and accept it, and you can be yourself, your real authentic self, is the best way to get rid of any of those securities.
Yeah.
And just to know, as a human being, we are social. And I'm sure that you came to the same realization on alone that we love being alone, but we are designed to be social. And to have other people look at you and say, I accept you. I love you. You're my, you know, I adore you. Whatever. To have that gratification is, we do want it. All of us.
Yeah.
We all want it. So trying to get that from people in general, I think is something that we're all going to strive to do. But it's hard because when you kind of feral like us in a way, there's a lot of people that are going to find you strange.
Yeah,
you're going to find you strange and weird.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the thing is, it's the majority.
Yeah. Well, yeah. No, yeah, I get that. I really do. I think I've found a way to walk that line pretty well.
Okay.
I don't know if I have great advice around it. I think I just have. You know, I've got my deeply feral side, and I try to go for my walk every morning and get out in nature. And, you know, growing up, we spend so much time outside. But there, you know, I also, you know, well, I don't work for anybody else. So there's that. I run my own business.
Okay.
I write my own books. You know, I have my own things that I put out. I teach, you know, I do whatever I want, really, whenever I want to, because I run it all myself. Which isn't always easier, but I wouldn't really want to be working for someone else. Just personally, I like working for myself. I like making my own hours. I like taking a week off if I feel like, or if I really want to work through a weekend, which I tend not to, but if I really need to get a project done, I can work on it and get it done and then take time off whenever I want to. I like that freedom and flexibility. So that has been a big part of it, is being able to have that. But also finding your people. And not all my people are feral. I'd just like to say that.
Yes.
They don't have to be the same as you.
Yes.
I mean, my best friend whom you met this morning is, you know, is
very different.
Very different from me.
Very different.
Yeah.
But
you know,
somehow the collaboration, I can see how it works.
But we love each other. Yeah. Yeah, we're best friends. We love each other. And, you know, we all live together in this house, right?
No doubt accepts you for who you are.
Yes.
Even though he doesn't quite relate to that side of you, maybe.
Exactly.
But he accepts it.
Yes. Yes. And vice versa.
And that's all we can ask for in other human beings, right?
Right.
Is exactly. Just you accept me and I'll accept you.
Mm-hmm. Well, so you don't have to be.
Well, Joel, look at like a lot of the folks that attend our course, you know, our hunting course, they are nowhere near feral, but they are very like-minded individuals just like us. And a lot of the thoughts and process and stuff like that, as far as humanity and, you know, love and all that stuff is the same, but as the wild aspect of it is what's so different, because it's so, maybe it's uncomfortable for some people and they just don't understand it because they've been kind of sheltered away from it from so long. But then you take some of those people and you put them in our environment, like you and I do with the course, and strip them of their phone. They have no service. They can't do anything. They're forced to be in this little community for a few days. And that's why so many people are like, oh, you've changed my life, because I didn't know. Like, I think those things of being wild and feral are barbaric. And we've, you know, we've moved out of that, right?
We're civilized.
Where really, when you look at, but look at us. We're being feral is some of the most healthy ways of life, period, because of the way we go out and the experiences and the adventures that we have and the tribulations and trials that we put ourselves in the wild, you know, like we're out searching for that. You hear so many people, oh, I got to take a vacation from my vacation, right? Well, whenever we get through with a challenge or we get through with alone or naked and afraid, we can't wait to go back. Like, what's that about? What is that about?
Well, I think we all have that deep primal side, and accessing it really gives us joy, right?
Yes.
But circling back to the bigger question, right? I think the key is to find something that can connect you to whomever you're with. And this is like, for example, we met at the Rabbit Stick Skills Gathering. And yeah, most people go in there, they're for skills, right? But one of their rules, which I love, is no religion and no politics,
yeah,
right? And if people bring up religion and politics, it's rock, sticks, and bones. That's what you're supposed to say, sticks and bones, right? And I love that we don't talk about that there, because that's not what it's about. Mm. It's not about what you believe or what you're doing or whom you're going to vote for. It's all about the skills. So that's our connective practice there. So I have made friends with people who are politically at the opposite end of the spectrum, religiously, you know, we have very different beliefs, whatever that is, right? But it doesn't matter, because now we've connected over something more important. We've connected over skills. So I think whatever that connective piece is you can find in other people really can help draw us together. And honestly, it's what our nation needs right now, because I don't want to go into that, but it's so messed up.
Yeah.
We all want the same things generally. Absolutely. 90% of the stuff we all want is the same.
And to your point, we can, if we really look into it, you can connect with almost anyone.
Yes.
Yeah.
You just have to find what it is.
You just but there will be, I mean,
food. We all love food, right? Well, yep. Let's talk about food. Yeah. We'll connect over food.
Yeah. Asking questions and listening helps a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. And really listening.
Yeah.
Because I do feel like there's this tendency to be heard, like people really want to be heard. And maybe that's a lot of insecurities. But the moment that you're saying something, the person is then looking and thinking, how can I one up, or how can I respond in a way that I can interject my experience?
Exactly.
Which I understand, people want to be heard, but man, there's so much to listen to.
The older I get, the more I listen and the less I talk. You know, now I don't ever talk about lone experiences or these things. Like, generally don't bring them up.
Yeah.
And I don't generally talk about them. I generally listen now, because I learn when I listen. I don't learn when I'm here listening to myself talk. I really don't. I mean, I know this is a podcast interview, so it's a little bit of a different format.
Yeah.
But in general, I try to listen. And the older I get, the more I listen.
Well, that's wisdom. So not only do you possess wisdom, but you possess, I mean, you're the whole package, Nicole. I mean, you are what, I don't like this term. I find it, like, with no disrespect, a very American term, but like, you're a badass.
Oh, I like that term.
I like badass. I think that fits.
And I feel I'm an elder now too. You know, now that I'm in my mid-50s and I'm getting there, you know, I feel I don't look like an elder sometimes, which kind of bothered me at times. Like, maybe I should be grayer or have more lines. I don't know. I'm pretty healthy. But because I don't feel like I look my age.
You definitely do not look my age.
Yeah, which I think most women would be like, I don't look my age. But part of me wants to look my age, because then, like, I'll be seen more as an elder. You know what I mean?
Interesting.
Yeah.
That just kind of shows how secure you are within yourself.
Well, your personality is nowhere near 54. That's part of the issue. Is everybody sees you as that 30-year-old that you act like. You're just so joyful and freaking for real. I mean, the glow about you is like, it comes across no matter what. I think that's super awesome.
Yeah. You know, in a world that is so dominated by males, and unfortunately, in my opinion, a lot of the kind of males that should have no business setting any examples or being leaders. It's so nice to come across a strong woman like yourself that I truly look at as being such an inspiration for all the young women out there.
Thank you.
I mean, you're so accomplished, capable. I mean, you've proved it. And your voice should be heard. Your experience should be told. And here we are. We're able to kind of take a little glimpse into it, eh, Cole?
Thank you both.
I was super excited whenever Joel, because this all kind of, you know, this came about pretty quick. Joel was like, I've got Nicole, she's ready to come on. And I was like, are you kidding me? I've been a huge fan because, you know, I'm a huge fan of Alone. And my mom's got one of your books. I think that's super cool. And there's no limitations. It doesn't matter if you're a woman or man or whatever. It's like your work ethic, it took you to the places that you are now, right? And your dedication to your gift and your love and your passion. I think that's such a great message for people, right? Like, look at where we are right now. We're here because this is what we love to do. And this is the path that's been laid down in front of us. And for you to be able to show that to so many people, like, I have a daughter, I have a 16-year-old daughter, and like, absolutely, I would love if she came out to be something like Nicole Palin. It's, you know, who wouldn't want their daughter to, you know what I mean? It's just, thank you so much for doing this. And, you're just super humble. And I am way too dumb, Nicole. I went to the eighth grade and I was like, Joel, like, this woman is got so much education, it like lifetimes compared to what I have. I'm going to sound ridiculous asking some of the questions, but yeah, thank
somehow
you.
It's slow, Nicole. Somehow you pulled it off.
it's doing fine.
Nature. How much more basic and primal is that?
Absolutely. Yep. Yeah.
Whenever we got a minute, I do have a question, from some folks on Facebook. if you wanted to touch on that real quick, and then Joel, if you wanted to go from there after that.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is J8Kester505 on Instagram. So he asks, he says, what's the best mental health advice you both have for putting yourself to the most extreme challenge in one's life? I'm sure there's fear and, of course, maybe doubt. But how do you overcome something like that? And he says that he's a big fan and absolutely respects, you know, everything that we do in, as far as Alone and the challenges that we're on. So, yeah, mental
health.
How
do you prepare for a big challenge like that if you want to get through it? How do you mentally prepare? Is that the question?
Yes, ma'am.
I would say do it in baby steps. So I think the big answer for that, if you're going to do an outdoor challenge, the answer is dirt time. That's the biggest thing. And that all the dirt time is actually spending time outside. I mean, people mostly are spending time, you know, getting their gear ready and watching YouTube videos and doing those things. But there is no replacement for time spent on the ground. And if you want to start off, if you're nervous, do it in your backyard to start off. You know, do an overnight. Do a two-night challenge, you know, then go for a weekend challenge. And if you want to challenge yourself, you know, try doing it without, you know, having a phone as a backup. I mean, turn it off, right? In case you really have an emergency. But otherwise, you know, turn it off and try for, you know, keep adding a day and just see how that is. But there's no replacement for being outside and doing things yourself and failing, by the way. You know, when I teach a class, let's say I'm teaching a figure four deadfall trap. If someone gets it right the first time, I'm bummed because they'll never learn it.
Yeah.
It's the people who get it wrong and do it again and do
go,
it again
and go
do
and
it
go,
again.
Until they get it.
And then they know it. Yeah. Every time they, you know, someone gets it right the first time in a class, I'm totally upset because they're never going to learn the darn thing. You have to fail. And you have to be okay with failing over and over again. And then you adapt and you get more flexible and you learn more because those mistakes, if you learn from them, are what's going to then feed into you. And so I think that's really important, being okay with failing, but you know, you're failing on a minor scale. It's not like you're doing anything. You're either by yourself or you're with a buddy and you're outside, you're with a friend and you guys can, you know, camp together or whatever it is you're doing. But do it, you know, do it in bit, but there's no replacement for just being on the ground and actively trying things.
Mm.
Yeah.
And I think that's such good advice. And, you know, like all of us are going to have bad experiences, challenging, fearful, intimidating experiences in life. And the more experience we gain in feeling those feelings, the better we'll be at handling them.
Yeah.
So if you put it into a practice, maybe daily or weekly, like maybe it's, you know, walking out in the snow right now. I mean, it just dumped a bunch of snow, standing outside without a shirt on for 5 minutes. Can I do 5 minutes?
Yeah.
There's enough fear and discomfort in that alone to challenge you.
Yeah, discomfort is key.
Is key.
Yeah, you have to get used to being uncomfortable and being okay with being disruptive and be okay with having discomfort in your life, because that is going to breed, that's going to get you stronger.
It's going to build character. It's going to make you stronger. It's going to teach you about yourself.
Yep.
And that's the thing about this modern day world, is that we have to seek a lot of these experiences.
It's so comfortable, right?
So comfortable. Yeah. Isn't it ridiculous?
That's a great question.
What I was, just to, you know, add to that, I think it's something that you can train, right? It's something, mental toughness is something that you can train. You're not going to be able to just jump out there and go do 57 days without having some sort of a mental fortitude to push you through that. And you already said that all the travel that you did and the places you went prepared you for that. So my advice would be, y'all, if you're trying to build that mental toughness, is, you know what? One day, don't turn that hot water on in the shower. Take that take that 3 minutes and deal with that. And then when you get through it, go do something else that is difficult and accomplish that and tell yourself that you can, and just all those things. Once you believe you can, that's what mental toughness is believing that you can and then pushing yourself all the way to that goal. Sorry to interrupt, Joel. Onward with your...
We've done really good for time. We've covered a lot. We've gone pretty deep. So I have one last question.
All right.
For our survivalists, bushcraft enthusiasts out there, what are five edible or medicinal plants that you absolutely have to know?
Well, when you're out in the field, I think the important thing is these are ones that like are kind of all around the world, right?
Correct.
So the number one is yarrow. Yarrow is key. So yarrow is what saved my finger. I didn't show it on the show. I cut my knuckle off on day 43 and it was really bad. But luckily, the next 2 days were a huge storm. I actually couldn't leave my shelter. It was so windy out.
And that's trees leaves, were falling. The leaves or the flowers?
The leaves are the flowers of yarrow plants. So luckily, I'd collected some earlier in the season, so I had them dried. So yarrow stops bleeding almost immediately.
Yeah.
It stops external bleeding, or if you take it internally, it stops internal bleeding, which is really important in the field.
Wow.
And it's antibacterial. So that is what saved my finger.
That's incredible. Yep. The yarrow is your first one.
First go-to.
Yarrow. I've seen yarrow heal a hematoma in 12 hours.
Yeah. It's incredible plant.
Incredible.
So that's one to know.
Yeah.
Number two, I would say, is plantain.
Okay.
It's now not the banana. It's the one that grows in a rosette on the ground. You'll see it. It's in everyone's lawn. Everyone tries to get rid of it. Mm-hmm. It's such a great, great weed. It'll push through anything. But it's good for any sort of, it draws things out. Mm-hmm. So if you get a sting, a bite, a snake bite, a splinter, anything like that, you can chew it up, put it right on your wound, and it will draw all that stuff out of it. It's also a great edible. I used to wrap my salmon in it and make little salmon tacos. Plantain's a great edible. It's also really good for your gut because it's a drawing thing, right?
Okay,
so if you take seeds and eat them, it'll just draw crap out of your gut.
So it'll draw the toxins out of your gut, too.
It will.
Ah, okay.
Dandelion, because everyone knows it, right? Everyone knows dandelion. So research it a little more. The dandelion root's really good for your liver. You can roast it and make it into like a coffee substitute.
Now, is that can you harvest the root all year long?
You can.
Yeah.
Okay. I usually say harvest roots in fall, but dandelions usually. It's fine. Yeah. They're prolific, right? And then, you know, you can, the flowers, I fritter them up in the summer. I eat the leaves. They're really healthy for you. So that's a really good one because most people already know it. They're just not using it.
They're not using it.
So just, you know, don't take it from a sprayed lawn.
Sure.
Yeah. But the next one is usnea lichen because it's pretty much everywhere.
Gotcha.
And it's sometimes people think it's a moss because it hangs from the tree.
Old man's beard. That's how my son knows it.
All right. So you know it's usnea if you pull it open and there's like a white little rubber band in the middle of it.
Yeah.
That's the key diagnostic. That one is, if I only had to pick like one medicine for the field, that would probably be it.
Oh, really?
Because it's antifungal.
I know it's antibiotic.
Yeah, like antibiotic, antifungal, antiviral, and antimicrobial. So it does it all. So I used to, for my water cation alone, I would cut up usnea and put it in it to keep it healthy, to make sure nothing was growing in it.
Yeah.
That was also the second thing I used on my wound. Okay. And it's a really great field dressing. And it's just really good for anything that ails you.
That's really good to know. And we just as we kind of get into the Cascade Mountains here in Central Oregon, it's everywhere.
Yeah.
And I mean, yarrow obviously is all year long. We can find it here in the high desert too.
Exactly. And these are all across the United States and Canada. I mean, really across temperate zones, even in Mongolia, there was yarrow. I mean, it's everywhere.
Yeah.
Fifth one. Wow. There are so many. I mean, I really like elderberry because it's such a great antiviral and I have to use it every day.
Elderberries. My wife is huge with elderberry.
Huge. It's great. Elderberry. It's great.
Which does have to be cooked in order to.
Yes.
You cannot eat it raw.
No, you can tincture it, but you have to cook it if you're doing anything else with it or make an elderberry syrup or something like that. It's one of my favorites. Really delicious, but do cook it and don't eat the leaves.
Don't eat the leaves. So five fantastic resources there to go and check out and research if. For those of you that haven't gone down the rabbit hole of medicinal plants, you definitely have some amazing resources. Nicole's books, I've got the Herbal Remedies book, and the Foragers, Guide to Wild Foods. Those are the two books I've got from yours and they are fantastic.
Thank you.
The amount of plants that you cover is astounding.
I'm working on a second edition of the Herbal Remedies book right now. It's almost done. I also have the Holistic Guide to Wellness, which is herbal protocols, science-based herbal protocols. And then my new Wilderness Guide just came out.
The Wilderness Guide, yes.
It's all on my website.
The Long-Term Survival Guide, fantastic. Yeah, thank you very much. You've given me a couple copies here, so I'll definitely take those and read those. It's been a good day in the bush.
Great first episode with our first guest. I think this turned out great, Joel. I think it was pretty flawless after we got some technical issues kind of worked out.
Yeah, we worked through the kinks.
Nicole,
hang out with Joel more. It was all good.
Yeah.
we got to know each other more and look forward to hanging out even more.
Exactly. Yeah. We live near each other, so that's so great.
Yeah, I'll have to come over whenever I come up. Nicole, can you give everybody your social media and your website and all that and places to find your books?
Best place to find everything is on www.NicoleApellian, all one word, APELIAN.com. There's links to Nicole's Apothecary on there as well if you want to check out my apothecary, or you can go to straight to Nicole'sApothecary.com. And my social is at Nicole Apellian. That's my Instagram. And I'm at Nicole Apellian Survival on Facebook. So, but my website has it all. So just go there, and I've got a searchable blog if for something that ails you. It's all based in science, and everything's very easy to find.
Your website is amazing. Yeah, your website's amazing, Nicole.
Your website's incredible, and don't forget the online course that she now offers. I'm very intrigued by that.
Yeah, I have a new herbal e-course. There's a link from my main website on NicolePellian.com. You can go to it, and it's a brand new herbal e-course. You can become an herbalist. I really worked hard on it.
And that must take a
while. It's only $39. I made it really cheap.
Oh, $39.
Yeah, I looked at the same course someone else had, a very similar. It was like $4,000. I wanted everybody to access it. So yeah, it's linked from my website. It's an amazing class. I'm so proud of it.
Good for you.
Kitchen herbalism. Yeah.
Awesome.
Do it all.
Check it out, everyone. And if you have not, you know, if you didn't grasp that whole conversation, let me summarize it. Eat mushrooms and get out into the woods.
That's awesome.
All right, brother. Nicole, and Joel.
Yeah.
Ending the podcast. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Really appreciate it. Love you, brother.
Thank you, too, dude. Love you, too. See ya.